man who puffs the big cigar turns all he touches into stone. The cash flows in from near and far when he picks up the telephone. The value of his property increases daily, no one knows. How much he owns and still he schemes, the more he buys, the more it seems. There is no limit to his dreams, and as the market booms, his empire grows.
Right, here we are. This is the third Wednesday with the Portland Assembly crew talking about housing issues. I'm host Paul Rowland for Wednesday Talk Radio. Good morning, Meg. Good morning, Sarah. I'm not sure your mic
is my mic. Not? Oh, there I am. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we have on the line Victoria Baranetsky, who is the general counsel at the Center for Investigative Reporting, which Reveal News is a project thereof. I will just say this once: you can actually listen to Reveal News on another radio station in town, namely OPB. I actually listened to it last night, Tuesday evenings from 10 to 11 on our competitor radio station. You can hear Reveal News, which is an awesome program. It delves deep. Go look at their website if you don't believe me. And if you haven't heard, check them out. It's both a podcast and a nationally syndicated radio program. So we are going to be talking about Reveal News suing of the Treasury Department to get information about the secret landlords buying up our American cities. I'll let Sarah get more into that with Victoria, but first let's introduce Victoria. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, all. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. We're very excited to have you.
I'm super excited.
Yeah, Meg is our data nerd, and she is very, very pleased to be here talking to you today. I can see her grinning over there.
It's true.
So we saw what you were doing on Reveal last week, and we're super excited, and so we reached out because we see a lot of correlation between the things that you're looking for in this lawsuit and the information that we're looking for up here in Portland. I know that the article and the Reveal piece focused on San Diego area, but we see not only the same actions but the same players up here. So we have no doubt that whatever you guys get a hold of will be totally relevant.
We wanted to start go ahead, Victoria.
I was just going to jump in and actually say that, so Aaron Glantz, who's the reporter who sort of came to me with the story and explained that a lot of this information was not public, is actually looking for a trove of data from the Treasury Department on a bunch of cities around the country. I think it's somewhere between 9 and 12, where there is an incredible amount of obfuscation, and essentially in all of those areas only 30% of the overall residential real estate owners are known, and so it's much larger than San Diego. I think in California, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Mateo, and Santa Clara were all cities actually that were demarcated by the Treasury as being target cities.
So let me just, I didn't probably introduce properly. So the Reveal story, the Aaron Glantz reporting, found that 30% of California's residential real estate purchases in major cities are being made by shell companies in cash. The situation appears to be very similar in Portland, as Sarah was saying, as we've been covering here on Wednesday Talk Radio, the third Wednesday edition. Aaron Glantz, we should note, is the author of Homewreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. That's quite the title.
I mean, it is.
Yeah, Aaron's really good with words.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's been actually a pretty illuminating cornerstone for our work up here. So can we talk a little bit more about the scope of the suit? Like
absolutely.
Yeah, great. Love to know like what kind of data you're looking for here.
Sure. So essentially, this is a lawsuit that we brought in December. And like I said, sort of Aaron approached us and told us there's this part of the Department of Treasury called FinCEN, which mm-hmm. stands for the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. Mm-hmm. And it's a bureau within the Department of Treasury. And FinCEN has a database. And FinCEN is charged with essentially looking into concerning data and information involving just this problem, right? Residential properties that are being usurped by shell companies, and then you can't identify who owns them. And so they have a lot of that information within their database. And essentially, Aaron wanted to get his hands on it. And as a lawyer, it's really interesting because that type of data is pretty straightforward. I mean, you take property law in your first year of law school, and you are taught that who owns property is something that should be known by the public, because that's how property transfers hands, and because property is about power, and people who own property have power. And so it's a pretty simple tenet, really. And so Aaron filed this FOIA request. The Treasury Department came back and denied it. There were a few more steps that we took. We appealed it. Treasury went back and said, okay, maybe there's an issue. And then finally, we didn't hear from them for months. And so we filed this lawsuit, and essentially the lawsuit is looking for specifically the owners, the names and addresses, the amount of money that was transferred, and the names of any purchasers of the properties with regards to all of these locations that we listed. So it's in Texas, Florida, New York City, mm-hmm. California, Hawaii, Nevada, Washington, Massachusetts, and Illinois. And these are places that the agency itself demarcated as being hot zones, essentially, for where there are these all-cash purchases of residential real estate by shell companies.
So I'm familiar not only just recently, also with this sort of new-ish mandate that FinCEN issued to those specific municipalities. I think as you said, I think there's 9 cities and then just a couple of counties within those, specifically
right.
requiring the title companies to record financial interest in those titles. And then they've sort of put some, my understanding is that they've put some framework around those indicators, if you will, that they look for in terms of signs of money laundering. So I think it has to do with cash purchases in those areas over, I think, $300,000 in purchases, and then some other things. But Portland's not on that list. There was an investigation here in 2015 by a company called Investigate West that did mm-hmm. that very same thing. They sort of got from a realtor with access to cash purchases. And at that time, there was some information here that could be gleaned publicly. But then the difficulty even then in Oregon, which is one of the 4 states in the nation that is hospitable to shell companies, but never sort of mentioned, along with Nevada and Delaware and Wyoming. But they discovered back in 2015, oh, look at Blackstone. Look at all of this cash coming up and buying up residential real estate. So we're particularly interested in those what that produces just even in what FinCEN has kind of put their arms around.
Well, and then also on a local transparency note, there was something that Meg discovered a few months ago and told us about, which was that there had been a change to the searchability of our database here. You want to talk about that real quick?
Yeah, and I hope Victoria that you will also pique your interest and perhaps you know, perhaps we can talk later. So not only, and I'll to Sarah's point, but going back to that 2015 survey, they had written some scripts that allowed them to sort of be able to glean that information that they were looking for out of the assessor's database. And then I built upon that in 2016, sort of their methodology, and focused in on a single developer. For a five-year in-depth analysis of all of that just particular developer's transactions, and then published a report, and it was relevant to some legislation that was happening that would have done statewide speculative upzoning, which has also now sort of been resurrected. But I digress. And then shortly after that, the assessor's office changed the way that their data was presented and added a different layer in, so you could no longer get that data, and locked down all of the sales history that actually showed buyer and seller. Now, at that point in the public, you would only see the last transaction, and some of those times were when an LLC, you know, an initial purchaser, then they would create an LLC and then just transfer the paper.
Well, and of course, we know that we've seen this happen where properties will change hands repeatedly over the course of even a couple of weeks, pushing that pricing up and that land value up. And so So the problem is we can now only see the very last outcome of that.
And sometimes the sales, and sometimes the last transaction on the deed is a $0 transaction, because all they've done is parent company A put it on their books, and then they formed an individual LLC just for that property, and then transferred the paper over into this LLC, and that's all you can see is this shell company. That's all the public can see. But after that, so between 2000, you know, up until just about March of last year, March or April, I believe, tenant advocates, data activists as myself, also there was a public portal where you could go in and just search by owner, and it was you know, on a map and information, and you could see, you know, who owns what. And even though there's still that layer of obfuscation with the LLCs, you could at least you know, sort of search by owner. And there was a lot of tenant advocacy going on at that time, as well as some reports. I also published a report, a 3-month in-depth study, where I grabbed all of the tax assessor's database information and then quantified and qualified how much residential rental property was owned by LLCs, limited partnerships, trusts, non-human entities, and to push some legislation here. In March, all of a sudden, on that public portal, the ability to search by owner disappeared. And it was gone with, you know, under the radar. And when we inquired, the bureau that has responsibility for that is responsible to the mayor's office, and they said the reason was to protect victims of domestic violence. There's already a process for that. They already obfuscate in public searches, for instance, the names of judges and high profile individuals. So there's already a process for that. But that was their excuse for taking away the public's ability to find out who owns what.
Also interesting to note that coincided with very large bulk purchases of single family real estate by Open Door.
Yes. Yeah, they spent they spent almost $60 million in 8 months, starting right after that.
So let's bring Victoria back. So you're hearing a lot of the various layers of obstacles. Tell us a little bit more about, so why specifically the Treasury Department? Obviously, are there any other ways to get this information?
Yeah, so some journalists, you know, across the country have worked really hard at identifying this information, essentially from cross-referencing various public filings. So Aaron wrote a story called Profiting Off Pain, where he was able to identify Thomas Barak as the actual owner of a LLC company that was owning various properties.
But who's a longtime Trump friend.
Exactly. And that process just took a really long time. Mm-hmm. similarly, USA Today did a story where they did something trying to find out who owns certain LLCs buying Trump real estate, and they were able to do it, but it took months upon months. And that's just not the amount of time that your average citizen has to dedicate to this type of sleuthing.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting because recently certain places have actually come to determine that, you know, that's not how our property system in this country should operate anymore. So I know that New York has considered passing a law that would require this information to be once again public.
I'm kind of interested. Actually, Meg, what did you want to go?
No, you go. What I have to say is complex.
I kind of want to know what do you think you're going to find out, and what are you going to do with it? I guess.
Yeah. Well, what we do with it is always up to Aaron, because I'm just their attorney, and so I help them when they come to my office knocking, asking for some assistance. But I have a sense that Aaron will probably write something. But, you know, this lawsuit was filed under the Freedom of Information Act, which is a legislation that was passed in the 1960s and allows the public to get access to public information, as long as it doesn't follow under one of the 9 very narrow FOIA exemptions. Mm-hmm. And so we sued the Treasury Department. We asked for this data, and they came back and said it was exempt because of Exemption 3, which essentially says there's this other statute called Bank Secrecy Act, and so therefore Treasury can keep it hidden under that legislation. And our argument is essentially going to come down to the fact that it doesn't fall under that other statute, that it clearly falls under a lot of other similar data that's disclosed all the time, and that knowing who owns property within this country is basic information that in no way causes concern for the agency to disclose. And I think, just like someone had said earlier, you know, there are other ways to hide, you know, concerning information around, you know, people's personal identities, but this is actually the opposite circumstance, where knowing who owns these LLCs is important, because knowing who owns land, once again, it's worth stressing, is a very important part of our democratic structure. Property is one of the most basic elements of our society, and who owns it impacts greatly how we live, who our neighbors are, you know, what kind of housing we have, how it interacts with our community. So, you know, it's funny, since this lawsuit was filed, there's been a large response. And I think that's just because there's sort of this common sense element around it, that you should know who owns a piece of land. And I think that's really struck a nerve with folks, especially at a time now where land has become such a tense matter of public debate and argument. So essentially, I think, you know, we're hoping to get that information. We're hoping to convince the judge that it's pretty straightforward as to why it should be disclosed, and that it's not something that should be withheld. I want to actually just interrupt myself and just say one last thing, which is very interesting, which is the Treasury Department is saying that the Bank Secrecy Act is the reason why this information should be withheld. But actually, when that act was passed, LLCs didn't even exist. So they weren't even a corporate vehicle to be used. So it's not even legitimate to argue that at that time that statute would have, you know, foreseen this type of withholding of information.
So I think it's interesting that you mentioned foreseeing this, because when we talk about this as if it's something that's just happened, rather than something that has been pretty carefully planned by politicians and developers and bankers, we see the way that professional politicians go back and forth between private sector, public sector jobs so that they can put the right legislation in place to allow these land grabs to happen, right? So what's the possibility, or what do you see as the parameters of using this information for the greater good, for the public good, like, for example, the legalities of, say, you know, eminent domain, once we've established that there are, you know, major corporations, like, how do we fight that sort of cooperative relationship, symbiotic relationship that has been built between corporate entities and the government at this point, especially just on housing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what our reporters do in our newsroom is often, it's just the first step of accountability, right? Mm-hmm. And so I help them get information from the government very often in these FOIA suits. And what they do is they then take it one step further and analyze it, understand it, try to figure out patterns. And I'm pretty sure that if we do get access to this data, which is unknown, right? I mean, I think it will be an uphill battle. I in no way want to suggest that this is a shoo-in. That Aaron, you know, will undoubtedly go through the information and try to suss out who's related to which property, you know, for how long, what that means, what that's done to certain areas. And then from there, you know, it's up to the public to determine what they want to do with that information, right? That's where the role of the media attorney sort of hands off to the journalist, and the journalist hands off to the public. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there's a plethora of ways that this information can be used. But I think the first step is really just knowledge about knowing who is where and what and why, and accountability. And from there, you know, there are a variety of measures that can take place. I mean, I think that the statute in New York plays into this similarly. I think that the notion is, you know, the first step is knowing who, and knowing why, and then moving forward from there.
So I think also, too, that where this lawsuit, even though it sort of specifically got some specific parameters and is asking those questions, part of Glance's reporting also sort of starts with and talks about and explores the sort of cataclysmic extraction of wealth through some of these finance mechanisms that used housing, financialized that debt, you know, and all these machinations to conjure, you know, trillions in fictitious wealth, and so a lot of his book also delves into that and the intersection of this sort of specific lawsuit, trying to determine and name some of that. For instance, the United Nations Special Reporter for Housing, Leilani Farah, has authored some reports and some studies that have discovered some of these things that now are sort of becoming part of this common conversation that has to do with global private equity, the same you know, unregulated banks that profited the most from displacing, you know, 10 million, directly displacing 10 million Americans through the foreclosure crisis, and where Glance was sort of also interested too is what happened next, and then discovering that some of the people that profited the most and that committed some of these deep acts of fraud are now people like Mnuchin. And it's interesting to me, that exemption that you were talking about, the bank secrecy, it's interesting to me because what that, for me as somebody who I also do a lot of corporate interlock mapping and studying, who is on the board of what private equity company, what are their subsidiaries, and then the same names keep coming up over and over again, and they've got, you know, headquartered subsidiaries in the Caymans or in Switzerland. And Leilani Farah has done a lot of work and a lot of those studies that, as you say, are extremely tedious to be able to figure that out. But what we have rising to the surface is telling us that these are not, you know, this is that there is this sort of monopolization of housing and obfuscation, and that there's a, that if we peel back the covers more than what we've already discovered, It leads to private equity that has their hands in people's pension funds, that is sort of in all of these things, not just housing. And so I can see why they would be sort of saying, like, this needs to be kept secret. How can we find this exemption? And that's what they pulled out, which is interesting.
Well, and a lot of it, if I'm correct, dates back to the bailouts and those same companies that are now, that we're now seeing make incredible profits and buy huge swaths of land, are the companies that were bailed out in 2008, 2010. So we paid for them to do this. We funded this.
It's also interesting. You said that at the time that bank secrecy exemption was created, LLCs didn't even exist. And the part of the cataclysmic financial device that almost broke the world economy was these mortgage-backed securities. And now Blackstone created rent-backed securities in 2012. And so now we see that the ability to not have to conjure all of this fictitious wealth based on trying to dupe individual mortgage holders into these subprime mortgages, because now we've got private equity with cash, and they're buying up multifamily properties and single family homes, and they're using that cash to build to rent. And so they don't even have to sort of fudge the paperwork that gets tracked, because cash is and real estate has always been sort of the preferred mechanism by which illicit gains get laundered, because it is untraceable.
Let me just reintroduce everybody. This is a lot of information and excellent, important information. On the line, we have Victoria Baranetsky, who's general counsel at the Center for Investigative Reporting, who is representing Reveal in their lawsuit against the Treasury Department to find out these shady shell companies that are behind this massive buy-up of real estate, which is driving prices sky high and leading to the second stage, I guess, or a third or fourth or tenth or a hundredth stage of dislocation and difficulty for people to actually afford to live anywhere, which is leading to the increased houselessness. So we have Victoria Baranetsky. We also have Meg and Sarah from Portland Assembly in our studios. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular host overall of Wednesday Talk Radio. I have various co-hosts on the different days. And we do, this is a call-in show. So you are invited to call in with your comment or question at 503-231-8187. I wanted maybe Victoria just to respond to what she's been hearing. But after that, I want to maybe read a few paragraphs. I think this article from back in September by Aaron Glantz from Reveal called "The Homewreckers: How Trump Cronies Are Sabotaging the American Dream." There's a few paragraphs that really draw succinctly what Meg and where the discussion has been going. But Victoria, you're not specifically trained, I guess, in housing law, but is there stuff that you've been finding out that resonates with what Meg is talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a few things. I'm definitely not trained in housing law. I'm a First Amendment media attorney, but I will say that knowing who owns property can, illuminate many things. So the Treasury Department itself has clarified that, money laundering is an easy tactic for these corporate vehicles. But then you have other things that have been mentioned, which it's easier to evict people when these properties are owned anonymously. It's easier to own more properties and then not necessarily have their interaction be done in like a meaningful way. So there's a lot of spots in our society where anonymity is good, but this is just not one of them. Aaron loves citing this quote. He says that someone from the Treasury Department, James Wright, an attorney, said it reminds him of Moldova after the fall of the Soviet Union, oligarchs running wild, stashing their gains in buildings.
Wow.
Right? And so there's just, it's anathema to our democratic structure, once again, to just not know who owns property. And there are a lot of elements as to what those harms can be. Money laundering being one, you know, easily evicting people being another, displacement. So the harms are multiple. And I think that's also, I wanted to add, why there's been also a interest by Congress to pass a bipartisan anti-money laundering bill, which came in the House in October and would require banks to disclose the true owners of shell companies to FinCEN. So there's an increasing awareness. So I think it's interesting because it was raised earlier that there's sort of been this slow systemic change to allow this to happen. Laws were passed and these corporate structures were created, LLCs and so on. And I think now that the problems of that have been borne out, there's a slow turn because people are sort of waking up that this just isn't good for anybody. It's not even good for the wealthy because ultimately it is, you know, corrupting our environment. It's corrupting our sense of structure. So it's the type of information that really needs to be made clear by the light of day.
You know, I think it's interesting that you brought up Moldova because honestly, that's what we see the eventual outcome of this. And yeah, there are slight steps in Congress being made to sort of rectify some of this, but it definitely feels like too little too late. Mm-hmm. And what this feels like is a pump and dump scheme. Mm-hmm. What this feels like is them finishing hollowing out the economy. You know, we don't have a lot of manufacturing in America anymore. We don't have a lot of stuff that we export, but what we do have is land. And it seems like the final value is being pulled out of that at this point.
I would also say, too, that you know, when you're talking about the impact of having these large, anonymous, private equity Wall Street landlords, what does that look like? It makes it easier to evict. And this intersection right now of what's happening here, we've got the Moms for Housing. And what happens, when they come out and they say, this is, you know, we have a Wall Street landlord and this is and there's empty houses because these empty homes are artifacts of financialization. And what happens when you threaten property, even if it's empty, is that they show up with battering rams and riot gear and military grade weapons, and they pull you out of that empty house because it is the property of the same people that are causing all of this economic violence.
So what Meg's referring to is a group called Moms for Housing in Oakland that have been occupying an unoccupied house in Oakland for the last month, 2 months?
November.
And 2 months. Yeah. It's a house that is owned by a company called Wedgewood, which is a derivative of Blackstone. Greystone, and has been sitting empty in that neighborhood for 2 years, formerly like majority black neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And they were removed the day before yesterday by the sheriff. They brought tanks, AR-15s, to clear a house occupied by two previously houseless mothers and their children. Just to give a little clarification on that situation, we've been following it pretty closely because we're very supportive. But yeah, it's definitely a solid, like, realistic outcome of this economy and this market. We've got some callers that we want to get to.
I think we got George first on the stack. Go ahead, George.
Hey, I want to thank you for this very revealing program, and please would you, I have two requests. One, would you please give the title of the book about this again? And then I have another just very brief comment about our government in this country, which we call a democracy. It's a magical democracy, which is now you see it and now you don't, and it ain't there. So please, I'll hang up, and I want to hear the title for the book again. But when just please continue. This is a marvelous program.
All right. Thanks, George. Okay, so it's Aaron Glantz, G-L-A-N-T-Z, and it's a long title, Homewreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream, the American Illusion. But anyway, just Homewreckers, Aaron Glantz will probably get you what you want.
What I love about the title, though, is that we live in this age of sort of like very short attention spans where people sometimes don't read the articles. And so sometimes you have to make the headline saying just like, okay, in case you don't have time for this or the attention, because there's a lot of meat in here, I'll just, you know, I'll give you all the meat, none of the parsley. Here you go. You know, like walk away with that. So sometimes you have to make a title that just says, you know, here's the Cliff's Notes, and maybe it piques your interest and like, and maybe you can crack the book open.
And let's just go to our next caller, whose name I can't remember. Maybe you can identify yourself, please. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Waylon.
Hi, Waylon.
Hello. Go ahead.
So there's a bit of a problem with when you talk about the context of this. You've been following this. We've talked about it a bit. But this is old. It's old. This has been going on for a long time since they started. They've been claim jumping since they started out here in the West. And there's a history of that displacement in that, right? We were talking about on the other shows where people were financing their actual displacement in this nation, and it's kind of been that way ever since. And so if we're talking about Oregon, it's not like there was ever any real plans for the laws out in Oregon, and now we're seeing it play out where you can grab this land and you can continue on this process of colonialization that they never stopped. And so they built this around that system. It's not like this is an aberration to the system, right?
True enough.
So, yeah, in any case, I mean, that in and of itself seems to be part and parcel for the solution to this problem. And they continue to use these same types of mechanisms of financialization to exploit and extort people. So it really seems like when you have a question of economic effectivity of the land and how to deal with that, and I'd be curious how this lawsuit can relate to that specifically, because eminent domain is what they use to displace people here already, and that's the history of it.
Yeah, so and I think you're pulling out a really important point, which is property is tense. It's a matter of massive public debate. It's a matter of power in this country, and that's not a new issue. And I think that it illuminates actually your point as to why this information is so important. And so the lawsuit is really just trying to actually, hammer at one very small part of a much larger problem, and all
you mean capitalism. That problem is capitalism.
Is just identify who owns it, right? It's such a simple question. It's just
capitalist.
Who owns the property?
Capitalists own it.
That doesn't right. And the thing is that it doesn't stop a lot of people from still buying up a ton of the property and consolidating it. It doesn't stop how that property is used or what the rules are around it. But it's just one step towards knowing who is the actual human, the person, not the LLC or the corporation or, you know, the attorney registered for the LLC, which is often what's also done on these forms. Who's the person responsible for this? And then you hope that you can get some more information that would follow, right? That would follow by other reporters going out and saying, this is the person responsible for these acts tied to this property.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, Waylon. Well, and let me just say that the number is 503-231-8187. Mm-hmm. We only have about a little over 15 minutes left, so you better call up right now if you want to get your question or comment in for Victoria Baranetsky, General Counsel at the Center for Investigative Reporting, talking about this lawsuit by Reveal News to get information from the Treasury Department.
So I think, you know, that question that, you know, if we're looking for the who owns what, the person, You know, we live in an era now too where corporations are people, and we know that corporations, you know, when we talk about colonialization, when we talk about gentrification, we are now in an era because of finance deregulation and financialization and rent back mortgage securities, where it's taken that and created you know, global corporate gentrification. I mean, there's like gentrification doesn't even our attachment and our visceral feelings about that word doesn't even capture the scope of this sort of global scale of corporate entities who are not humans, who are consolidating not only the building and the buying and the renting, but wrapping it up and financializing it and trading it like stocks.
Well, we were talking about this the other night. Like, we've talked about the Chicago School on this show before, which was in the 70s. What, Milton Friedwater?
Friedman.
Sorry, wrong one. Milton Friedman trained a bunch of economists and sent them off to South America to, again, hollow out the economy, to push neoliberalism. And this, to me, feels like that experiment expanded to a global scale. Mm. Like, we have this weird pushback in American, like, conservative politics against globalism by the very people who have made our homes global financial commodities.
And yet at the same time, we also have the UN Special Reporter for Housing, whose charge it is to go around the world and to say, like, you know, the UN has declared that housing is a human right, access to housing, adequate housing is a human right, and goes around the world and starts to see these patterns. Not only is there a global crisis of affordability, but the same global private equity companies are buying up all of the property and financializing it all over the globe. And then you have global real estate speculation. And then you also have, in all of these places, a disproportionate amount of vacant housing, while you have a disproportionate and rising amount of people who are being rendered houseless, and these artifacts of financialization, and this is someone who's going around the globe and saying, this is the pattern here, and this is happening in your town, and it's happening all over the globe, and it all leads to the same global actors who are all conjuring trillions and trillions in fictitious wealth and cleaning their money and cleaning their cash through real estate and through obfuscating it in all of these all the ways that you can create shell companies all over the world.
And I think we have another caller. I believe it's Craig. Hold on. I just wanted to, you know, and one thing I think is what I find so important about this particular program, the Third Wednesday Show, is the way it's shown to me really clearly that, you know, just this idea, the distraction, well, I think it's largely distraction. This idea of build more affordable housing. It's just one of those solutions that's a solution only because people aren't really willing to look at the actual source of the damn problem. Mm. The source of the problem is what we're talking about, this massive speculation on housing, which is jacking up the prices, closing the market, restricting the market so people can't get easy access to, if they can buy it, where they can't rent anymore because the prices have been jacked up by these artificial mechanisms. But instead, we're, you know, it's like three card Monte. We're looking at everything except what's actually happening. And it's like, no, building more housing is just, in some senses, exacerbating. We're just feeding fire to this ridiculous growth economy to begin with. Anyway,
yeah, we talk about let's build more affordable housing. We have already built. At the height in 2008, when the economy was collapsing, there were almost 20 million vacant homes in the U.S. And as of, like, you know, third quarter 2019, there's 17 million vacant homes, and only half a million houseless individuals. So that arc never tanked. That capitalism creates this surplus. We don't need to build more affordable housing. We've already built it with private pension money that gives private equity their liquidity.
yeah, we already built it, and we already paid for it.
We paid for it. Just in Portland last year, renters paid over $4 billion just in rent. So think about that.
So
we've already paid for it.
Let's go ahead, Victoria, before we get Craig. Go ahead.
I just want to add real quick, which is, there was also a comment about how this is sort of an international crisis as well. And, you know, it's true that this is something that reaches globally. But it is interesting, something that we added also in the complaint, which is actually many countries around the globe actually affirmatively require for the names of owners, beneficial owners of property, to be disclosed. So there's a report that was put out called by the Global Research Center, and a report by the Law Library of Congress, and they surveyed all these laws across the globe, and they found that in the European Union and 29 countries across the globe, many laws actually require for that information to be public. So it's an aberration in the United States that this is information is kept secret. In some ways, you might even argue that the U.S. laws are acting as a shelter for a global problem.
I would agree, right? Rather than argue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, another sort of interesting tidbit is that, you know, property, I've highlighted this before, but property really, this is just a fundamental part of, you know, having this information be public is a fundamental element to having our democracy function and function fairly and equally, and, you know, with right consideration of all citizens. Property is mentioned 4 times in the Constitution, whereas privacy isn't mentioned at all, for example. And that might surprise people, but it's because even the founders knew, right, that was just an elemental part of our society and our structure. And so, once again, I'm just trying to highlight, the importance of this. And even in a changing world, when we come back to it at the end of the day, land is still everything. Land is what we're on. Land is what we interact with.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. The constitutional statement of land ownership for a bunch of people who were in the process of stealing a bunch of land. It continues to this day. So that's a strong legacy there. Should we have Craig?
Yes.
On? Yeah.
Hey,
Craig.
You're still waiting.
Still there?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. And what I wanted to offer is possibly framing some of this a little differently. Carl Jung once said, enlightenment isn't about imaging figures of light, but about making the darkness conscious. And I think that if we understand how homelessness and helplessness have become so entwined. And why is that? Were the pioneers homeless? Were the indigenous cultures homeless? What is it about our collective unconscious the context for these disconnections at the most basic of levels?
I mean, I would say it's not collective unconscious so much as very real property laws that have been instated by the rich in order to specifically disenfranchise people. Like, it's not magagical. It's absolutely what capitalism does. So I think that our collective unconscious needs...
We have continued to essentially kill the buffalo for its tongue with every natural resource that we have gone after. That we don't have a clue about the waste, the unsustainable approach, the linear, logical, terminal capitalism that ensues every time. And until we start understanding things cyclically and holistically and consequentially, we can't get there from here. And that the base problem,
right,
as Gus Speth says, is not environmental issues. It's issues of our values. It's issues.
Well, we could go. We only have about 10 minutes left. We could go around and around this. I sort of agree with what you're saying, but I think that there's a lot of people who have understood the problem holistically. The problem is that how do you actually engage with the powerful people, institutions, structures, mechanisms that dominate our lives? That's it's a problem of organizing and dealing with power. But anyway, we have one other caller. Let's quickly get Art, and then let's wrap up this conversation with Victoria Baranetsky. Go ahead, Art.
Hi there. I'm wondering if you've heard of a program that was started in early 2001 by the Bush Jr. administration called the Ownership Society.
Not familiar, no.
It was really the basis of the subprime mortgage program that allowed people with lower incomes to move into older homes, and people went from there to move up to newer ones. But I had a time in 2007 where a balloon payment was going to be made. And in 2001, I went, oh, wait, and I just predicted that something was going to happen big. So that program is kind of something to learn a little bit more about, I think. But very interesting, informative conversation today. Thank you.
I think I'll make a note of that too. But one of the things too that that brings to mind, and Victoria, I think, not that this is necessarily sort of the scope of the lawsuit, but one of the things that's in Glantz's book and that he's been talking about on various programs too, that is relevant right now, is the Community Reinvestment Act, and that was one of these things that right now Mnuchin, as the sort of Secretary of the Treasury, is one of these tacit, if you will, acknowledgments about what the housing crisis and how all of the fraud and the financialization had extracted specifically targeted African American communities and communities of color for vast extractions of wealth and exploitation and vulture capitalism. And so the Community Reinvestment Act, said, you will not redline. And right now, the Treasury is trying to roll that back, and I think that Glantz was just in. I think he was just testifying yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, before the House Committee on Finance. Very sort of interested, and so he's also talking not only about our current Treasury Secretary's previous life in direct involvement in fraud and this extraction of wealth, but also fast forward now to the same actors trying to get around that so that they can in effect redline once again.
Well, and then that goes in with policies like RIP, which is Residential Infill Project, which is going to be voted on here this week.
Absolutely.
And I know that they had passed one last year in Minneapolis, and they're seeing some pretty devastating results from that, which is what was predicted. And which is why, we are advocating against residential infill here, because it goes back to those same original bad policies.
We only have a couple minutes left. I just want to give Victoria a chance to just maybe restate again and maybe sort of draw some concluding remarks of what this lawsuit against the Treasury Department is designed to do.
Yeah, so I think, to sum it up, I think the lawsuit is trying to use a very important statute called the Freedom of Information Act to get what is very simple but powerful and meaningful information, which is the private beneficial owners of private property. Meaning who owns, what's the literal name of who owns what piece of land in our country.
And that is something that's become increasingly more difficult to get and also increasingly more important to get, as, you know, there are a variety of shell companies that are used to obfuscate who owns property, which allows for landlords to sometimes engage in things as bad as money laundering, and also just doing things as simple but as also equally powerfully problematic as, you know, evicting people with ease and not being held accountable. And if I could sort of land on one word, that's sort of it. That's what this lawsuit's about. It's about how knowledge can create accountability. And that's something that we need, in particular, when it comes to something as profound as the property in our country and who owns it.
And I think that we can't, that without transparency, there is no accountability. We'll be watching, I'll be watching this very carefully. This is, you know, not only sort of validating for a lot of the things that we've been talking about, but also some of the data that we've been trying to get to, and how tedious it is when it should be very simple, because they've already got that information in public agencies.
So thank you for you know, filing the suit and doing this work, because it's going to help a lot of people in a lot of places working on this problem.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do it, and thank you for having me.
All right.
Thanks so much for joining us. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you.
And that was
the
last.
Total pleasure of mine.
Great. That'll be the last word. This is Paul Rowland with Meg and Sarah, and thanks again to Victoria Baranetsky. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO Community Radio.